Hamilton 1916, a year in review. In the rest of the world in 1916, Europe was at war in the early stages of World War I, or what become to be known World War I. Mexico was in the midst of its revolution, and they were chasing Pancho Villa all over the place. The Saturday Evening Post published its first Norman Rockwell cover. The Boy Scouts of America were incorporated. The National Park Service was established. The top movie of the year was D.W. Griffith's Intolerance with Lillian Gish. The top songs were O Sole Mio by Caruso and Pretty Baby by Billy Murray. On Broadway, the big show was, I'd never heard of this until I looked this up, Two Chin Chow with Tyrone Power. And apparently it ran for like 5 years for 2,238 shows. The books that came out that year included Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce, Kafka's famous Metamorphosis, you know, the guy that turned into a cockroach, and Carl Sandburg published his book of Chicago poems. President of the United States was Woodrow Wilson, and he would be reelected later that year. The Ohio governor was Frank B. Willis. Our senators were Warren G. Harding, who later, of course, became president, and Al T. Pomeran. I never heard of that. You know, how soon we forget. How soon we forget. And our third district congressman was Warren Gard, who was the brother of the publisher of the Hamilton Evening Journal, as a matter of fact. My first little bit of news isn't specifically Hamilton, but it does have a big impact. I mentioned earlier that the flood was just 3 years ago, and people were still reeling from that. And one of the first things that happened, even before the Conservancy got itself totally on its feet, they had a building. On January 1st, it was reported, today, Miami Conservancy directors and their forces occupy the new Conservancy building nearing completion at Monument Avenue and Jefferson Street in Dayton. Schenck and Williams, architects, have made a building record in the work. The building has been constructed at the expense of and is a gift of E.A. Deeds, president of Delco. He has made of it an architectural structure of which Dayton may well be proud and gives title to it and the ground it occupies to the Miami Conservancy District. Overlooking the river, the new Conservancy building defies flood and fire in its construction. Not one inch of the building is made of wood. It is practically fireproof, while the concrete, marble, iron, and copper from which it is built stand proof against all damage which might result from water. I don't know if you've ever been in that building, but it is pretty amazing. It's just, it has this Art Deco flair, and it is very ornate. They described it in great detail, but I'll just give you some of the highlights here. It has two sets of double doors made of copper guarding the entrance. The entry itself is built with walls of Columbia gray marble with a base of Verdi antique marble and is separated from the main hall by the second set of double doors. A marble and bronze stairway leading to a landing is the principal feature of the main hall in the first floor. As in the rest of the building, the plastered walls of the main entrance have been painted ivory gray, while all the window casements are of white Vermont marble, and the floor is made up from Tennessee marble. Leading off the hall, which is 17 by 20 feet wide, are four bronze doors, one from the main entrance, one leading to the basement stairs, one to the rear entrance, and one to a main exhibit room. Measuring 40 by 68 feet, the main exhibit room is decidedly the showplace of the building. It occupies all of the lower floor with the exception of the hall. With a 14-foot ceiling with plastered walls and painted gray and ivory, and with large plate glass windows surrounding three sides, it is wondrously light and airy. As in the rest of the building, that too is built with marble floors, marble and copper window easements and trimmings. The ceiling is beamed and corniced. Copper chain chandeliers support etched inverted globes. A border of Verdi antique marble forms a square on the Tennessee marble floor. Hamilton has a new mayor today, John A. Holzberger. They had many flowers for the new mayor. The courtroom in the city building was crowded this morning at 10 o'clock, the hour set by Mayor-elect John A. Holzberger to assume the duties of his office. Ex-Mayor Fred A. Hinkle made a short talk. Mayor Holzberger then spoke and outlined the policy that he intended to follow during his administration. He urged everyone to cooperate to make this administration the best that the city has ever had. Mayor Holzberger then announced his appointments. Shortly after Mr. Holzberger's talk, the little niece of the city solicitor, Kohler, was lifted up to the stand and placed a wreath of flowers over the head of the new mayor, saying that she crowned him mayor of the city. this idea developed from an incident which occurred during the primaries when, before the votes were counted, Kohler's niece remarked that she would crown Holzberger mayor of the city. Holzberger then himself promised the little girl that if he was elected, she would allow him to do that. Many of the men who had seen a number of ceremonies when the mayor was sworn into office aver that the display of flowers received by Holzberger was the largest ever given a man coming into that office. The display was both varied and beautiful, and the flowers adorned the judge's desk from which the talks were delivered. January 3rd, stranger even than unbelievable fiction, is the story of two deaths, one in far-off Kyoto, Japan, the other in Ross. Both occurred at the same hour, the same day. It was the son in Kyoto, his father in Ross. Reverend Raymond T. Gorbold, 39, a young Presbyterian missionary, ignorant of his father's failing health, took suddenly ill last October in Kyoto, Japan. He was too ill to be told anything which might cause him worry. He was suffering from heart trouble. At Ross, his father, Fred Gorbold, a well-known miller and businessman, was stricken almost the same hour of the same day his missionary son took ill. He, too, was kept in ignorance of his son's illness, lest the news might cause a relapse. Both grew weaker. The family of Reverend Gorbold in Kyoto cabled the condition from time to time to the family here, and the home folks sent messages to Reverend Gorbold's wife of the approaching end of the father. Neither father nor son knew each other was ill. A cablegram from Dr. Albert Gorbold Saturday brought the sad news of his death, giving the day and the hour. Reverend Mr. Gorbold was educated at Lane Seminary in Cincinnati. When he completed his studies, he wanted to go to Kyoto, the great city of learning of Japan, as a missionary. The Presbyterian Mission Board refused to allow him to depart because he had a weak heart. Not discouraged in his ambition, young Gorbold got the financial aid from his father and went as a teacher and missionary to Kyoto and attained great prominence. In a few short years, he made a record seldom attained by any in the foreign field of missionary work. He was loved and respected in Kyoto and succeeded. Several times when he returned to the States for a visit, he was in great demand as an orator throughout the country. His lectures were given in many cities, and his oratory was commented upon by the secular as well as the sectarian press. When a schoolboy, Mr. Gorbold was a correspondent of the Hamilton Evening Journal. We had a lot of labor troubles in 1916, and this is the first of a couple incidents. Two men were shot at the H.P. Deutscher plant, one man placed under arrest. The first serious trouble in connection with the present labor troubles in Hamilton developed at the plant of the H.P. Deutscher Company Wednesday evening at 4:45, when the men who have been working in the plant since Monday were leaving for home. They were being taken away in automobiles when either strikers or strike sympathizers made an attack upon the machine. As a result of this attack, it is charged that William F. Schneider, an employee of the H.P. Deutscher Company, drew a revolver and fired. John Callahan of South 9th Street and Paul Sebastian of Vine Street were each shot in the thigh, but neither seriously injured. The trouble at the Deutscher plant caused much excitement, and a number of persons hastened to the scene to see what was going on, and thus only aggravated the conditions existing or exposed themselves to possible injury. Deputy sheriffs and police were called upon to the scene and soon put an end to the disturbance. When the shop of the H.P. Deutscher Company opened Monday morning after being closed for several months on account of a strike of the molders, rumors became current of trouble brewing. The first indication was noticeable Tuesday morning when D. Leach allegedly hurled stones at the automobiles of Frank Graff, which was in charge of Leroy Daly and had been taking employees to the shop, and was arrested for disorderly conduct but released on an appearance bond. The fact of his arrest and the subsequent arrest of Leroy Daly, charged by Leach with assault, interested the strikers and their sympathizers, including a lot of women of the neighborhood and other factories, to congregate near the Deutscher shop to await developments. it is estimated that nearly 800 strikers and spectators congregated in front of the shop and the vicinity about 4 o'clock Tuesday afternoon, and when at 4:45 o'clock, three automobiles in charge of Leroy Daly, Frank Graff, and Herbert Twitchell began to fill with employees who were to be taken home, some persons began to throw stones, slag, and pieces of brick bats at the men in the automobiles. Some of the employees jumped from the machines and took refuge in the shop from the fusillade of missiles, and it is said to begin to shoot from the shop. While the more courageous of the strikers were being taken away in automobiles, another shower of stones fell on the men in the machines, and a few were hit, but not seriously injured. During this attack, William F. Schneider, an employee of the H.P. Deutscher Company, drew a revolver and, in the excitement, shot into the crowd. During the general shooting, which followed the attack with the stones and slag, bullets flew in every direction, and it is said that fully 50 shots were fired and two men were hit by flying balls, John Callahan of South 9th Street, a stove molder, and a member of the Socialist Local, who is also a member of the press committee of the Molders Union, and Paul Sebastian, 23, who lives on Vine Street and is by occupation a painter. Both men were hit in the right thigh, and the wounds of either are not serious. When the riot broke out, the police department and Sheriff Metcalf and his deputy Tom Hill were notified, and in a short time, there were six officers, four special deputies, with Sheriff Metcalf himself dispersing the crowd and bringing order out of the excitement. The police, after the shooting, arrested Schneider. He was locked up in the police station on the charge of shooting to wound, and Judge Sank fixed his appearance at $2,500, which is given by Gus Schwinn late Tuesday night. The riot did not prevent some irresponsible persons from proceeding to the home of Claude Freeman, superintendent of the Deutscher shops, and hurl a couple of stones against the dwelling, and the police department was notified. The stone thrower was not a striker, but some person who wished to show his sympathy with the strikers. No arrests were made, and no other trouble was experienced during the night. There were wild rumors after the shooting that a woman named Reed was hurt by a stray ball and that children were wounded, but these stories were found to be based on reports that originated from the excitement and not true as far as could be learned. Here's another one. Hamilton's Molder strike finally terminated last night in a tragedy when Coleman J. Brown, a striking molder living with his wife and two small children at 623 South 11th Street, was shot and almost instantly killed at the Canal Bridge and Grand Boulevard, and Well Radowitz and C.M. Coyle were also shot, but not seriously. The shooting occurred between men employed at the plant of the Hamilton Foundry and Machine Company in East Hamilton and strikers who had congregated at the Grand Boulevard Canal Bridge. Lee Stidham, Boone Pace, and Dillard Begley, all natives of Kentucky, have been placed under arrest in connection with the shooting and are held under the temporary charge of carrying concealed weapons, the police charging that each man, when arrested, had a gun in his possession. When, on Tuesday afternoon about 4:45, the strike at the H.P. Deutscher plant terminated in a riot and two men each carried away a revolver ball in his thigh, it was believed that this would be a lesson and that all disturbances would cease. This was, however, not the case, as shown Wednesday afternoon at about 4:30 o'clock, when 300 persons, consisting, it is said, of strikers and spectators, congregated at Grand Boulevard and the canal, and the result of the toll of one death for one man and the wounding of two other men was asked. The men were shot by several men who were fully armed and did not deny that they discharged their revolvers four or five times in a crowd of people, many of whom were simply spectators, to see what could be of interest to them. What led to the shooting was the opening of the shop of the Hamilton Foundry and Machine Company in East Hamilton and the forwarding of their employees by means of a streetcar to their homes without being molested. The streetcar used was filled with men from the shop, and as it was passing Mitchell's Saloon at Grand Boulevard in the canal, a party of men in the crowd congregated at that point and began to throw a fusillade of stones and pieces of brick. The windows of the car were shattered, glass flew in every direction, and some of the stones struck some of the men seated in the car. The car finally passed, and then the shooting up of the crowd of men from which the missiles were thrown came from another party of men standing in the street, and those unfortunate enough to be found by the flying bullets were Coleman J. Brown, 31, a striker and molder, who lived with his wife and two little children. at 623 South 11th Street, who was given his death wound by being hit below the left shoulder. Well, Radowitz of 28 Garden Avenue was a striker who was wounded in his right foot. C.M. Coyle, also a striker who resides with his family at 1219 Sipple Avenue, received a flesh wound in the back. It was also a big year for the grip. Who knows what the grip is?
Flu.
The flu, yeah. Yeah, it's an old word for the flu. Actually, I looked it up, and it comes from the French, meaning actually to grip. But the reason they started using that is because there's a Russian word that means the same thing that sounds like a cough, they thought. So they started using, I don't know, you figure it out, you know. An epidemic of grip has been, usually they spell it G-R-I-P-P-E. You know, I don't know why they have it just like that in the headline. An epidemic of grip has been prevailing throughout the U.S. with very serious results in the East, Chicago and Cleveland, Columbus, Ohio having at the present time 3,000 school children out on account of the grip. A census of the grip cases in the city of Hamilton was taken by the health department, and up to date, so far as we've been able to ascertain, there have been 1,568 cases of grip in the city since the epidemic began, a period of less than 3 weeks. There are at the present time under treatment 498 cases of grip in the city. Of the 1,568 cases which have occurred, 10 cases have developed into pneumonia, with, so far as we've been able to ascertain, no fatal results in any case. That would change in a couple years. This is a report from a Board of Health meeting. A most important motion carried that the mayor and chief of police be requested to be very strict in the enforcement of the anti-spitting ordinance during the existence of the epidemic. Makes sense to me. Four now face murder charges from the labor trouble. Held for murder was Lee Stidham, Boone Pace, Dillard Begley, and Robert Pace, charged with carrying concealed weapons. So I put this in here because it just kind of gives an example of how we're still really scared of the river at this point. Now, this is before the Conservancy did all of its work. So you would often see headlines like this, no danger of flood stage in the Miami River. Word from the north, the Conservancy, is that the river will not go much higher. At a meeting of the Conservancy directors in Dayton this morning, it was decided that should there be any danger of the Miami River reaching a flood stage, ample warning would be given to all persons. The directors will remain in Dayton to watch the situation, but they are not apprehensive in the least, owing to the fact that the rainfall has not been sufficient to cause a dangerous stage of the river to be reached. This is just a really weird little story. Get the child a wooden dog. It will serve the purpose and will do no harm, is the advice of Health Officer Landis of Cincinnati, given at a conference with Health Officer Smedley of this city and several prominent physicians of Cincinnati Saturday. The conference was held regarding the mad dog scare and the rabies. Health Officer Smedley believes that the question is one that should be taken up by the city and a plan should be outlined to get rid of all stray dogs. Regarding pet dogs for children, Smedley remarked that a dog is just like a person, liable to get out of sorts at times, and during those times is more than liable to bite the child. A case of rabies may result. A child should be given a toy dog. It will soon get accustomed to that. After a time, the child will enjoy the toy dog as well as the real dog. I got news for him. That ain't the case. That there was one death in the city last year from rabies and that nothing should be left undone to prevent a recurrence of this event was the opinion of Officer Smedley. This is kind of funny because, you know, now we're getting ready to put in a nice big park, you know, close to the river. So apparently we had plans to do one. And you can see the map here. Here's High Street and this is Monument Avenue. This is the hydraulic, which is now Market Street. So they were going to build a nice decorative bridge here and then put a bandstand right there. Isn't that nice? J.E. Freudenberger, landscape architect of Dayton, has just completed an elaborate plan for a park system in Hamilton, which was submitted during the last week to the commission in Butler County Capitol, named for the purpose of preparing a plan for the adornment of the Miami River Bank north of the new High and Main Street Bridge and on the east bank of the river. Remember, we just built that bridge. I think they dedicated like in May the year before. The plans call for the beautification of the land as far north as Dayton Street for two squares. The old Hamilton hydraulic will pass through the land proposed to be beautified, but this will be in part covered by a handsome bridge. A pergola is to be built at the north end of the park, right there. Kind of see it there. With a bandstand in between it and the hydraulic bridges. Attractive walks will lead from High Street and also from Monument Avenue into the park, and shrubbery, flowers, and grasses will add to the decorative scheme. At the intersection of High Street and Monument Avenue, a wide, attractive entrance will lead to the park, which is almost 2 acres in extent. It is designed to give the Hamilton public a spot for recreation. The tract was formerly used as a dump and has been an eyesore for many years. According to Mr. Freudenberger, the park will be one of the most attractive small parks in the state. Nice plans, huh? Boom! Arthur Morgan has something to say about that. Arthur Morgan is the engineer for the Miami Conservancy District. He saw that previous article, and the next day he sent a letter to the Parks Commission and said, you can't do that because we're going to dredge the river, and that land isn't even going to be there anymore. And so you know what's happened to that. And then a week later, here's what a godlike person Arthur Morgan was at the time. That's his picture on the front page of the Journal News there, or the Evening Journal, when he announced his plans. I'm not going to read all that for you because you know what they did is the river was just a little channel running through town, but they widened it. And, you know, now it's like I forget how big, but we put up that marker that shows where the original channel is and how much wider it is now. It's all the concrete that they built and everything like that. Here's a little summary. Yeah. Engineer Morgan tells the Evening Journal that the high levee at the New River will absolutely protect the Third Ward from the flood. The CH&D Railroad Bridge must be raised. 4 Mile Creek will be straightened and its course changed. Parts of the Niles, Black Clawson Company, and Sterling Paper Company will be cut away. All buildings along Monument Avenue from High to Buckeye will go. Champion Coated Mill retaining wall will be the line on the west side. Probably all of the Gordon Building and Hills Building, I don't even know what those are, must give way. Residence properties along A Street will be removed. The river below the railroad bridge will be straightened. Down by the water plant where there's that little reservoir there, that used to be the riverbank, but they made it straight to go straight through there. Bottom of the riverbed through the part of Hamilton is to be cemented to prevent wash of the banks. Morgan says, Hamilton will be made safe from floods. So there you go. And he's right. February 25th and 28th, we had resolutions to the shooting incident where the fellow was killed. And it's not really good news, I don't think. A final entry was placed. The coroner made his report and said that they could not tell that he was killed by persons or persons unknown. So the final entry was placed on the record of the clerk of courts late Thursday afternoon, quashing the indictments against Lee Stidham, Boone Pace, and Dillard Begley, who were indicted by the January grand jury for carrying concealed weapons. Before the entry becomes effective, however, the three men will be required to give a bond to appear in court. So they never went to trial for that strike killing, even though they'd been indicted for murder. On March 1st, we lost one of our most prominent citizens, J.C. John Clinton Hooven, manufacturer, industrialist. Colonel John Clinton Hooven is dead. Life's end for him came suddenly at the family home at South B Street and Ross Avenue at 1 o'clock this afternoon. The death of Colonel Hooven was very sudden. He had been able to sit up practically all of the morning and took his place at the family dinner for lunch. He had enjoyed a portion of the meal with those about him when he asked for a glass of water. Mrs. Hooven poured the water and was just handing it to her husband when his head dropped forward, and before anyone realized what was happening, life's end had come and Colonel Hooven had passed into the eternal sleep. The announcement of the death of Colonel Hooven was as great a shock to his friends as it was to his family, for while it was known that he was in failing health, it was still generally understood that he was in no immediate danger and that he might enjoy months, if not years, of life. Colonel Hooven's health began failing him several years ago, but with a persistence and tenacity that marked his entire career, he would not relinquish his hold upon his business interests and especially devoted his time and energies to the affairs of the Hooven, Owens, and Rentschler Company, of which he was the president. At times, it seemed advisable that he should relinquish even these duties, but the company and its vast businesses was the pride of Colonel Hooven, and while he seemed willing to gradually relinquish other interests, still he devoted all the time that he has to the success of the company's business. Gradually, however, the condition of his health became such that he was compelled, with great reluctance, to give up his active participation in the affairs of the company. That was early in the year. Since that time, Colonel Hooven has been confined to his home, attended with the best of care by the most efficient and most versed physicians, but it had become apparent weeks ago that life's course was almost ran for him, and those nearest and dearest to him waited hopefully at times, despairingly at others, for the end that must eventually come. Colonel Hooven himself was cheerful and hopeful. He saw the bright side of everything, and despite his gradually declining health, he was filled with hope. This was one of the sustaining features of his illness and was a great comfort to his family and to his friends. Colonel Hooven was the holder of vast business interests. He was the president of the Hooven, Owens, and Rentschler Company, the president of the Republican Publishing Company, the president of the Dayton Rubber Company, president of the Cincinnati, Lawrenceburg, and Aurora Traction Company, a member of the Hamilton Club and the Butler County Club, a stockholder in the Second National Bank, and aside from the interest held by Peter G. Thompson, the largest stockholder of the Champion Coated Paper Company. Colonel Hooven personally was a most affable man, cordial, kindly, and considerate. He won friends among all classes of men and held their friendship because he changed not with the time or conditions nor the seasons. He was a citizen of which Hamilton could well be proud, public-spirited and generous, and one who accepted the duty of citizenship with the full realization of its meaning. On March 2nd, they gave the price tag on the flood prevention, $23 million. Which I used a Bureau of Labor Statistics calculator, and that would be $500 million in today's. So Arthur Morgan promised that Hamilton will be made secure from floods 40% larger than that of March 1913. So they did a good job. This is a cute little story. Good paddling for Charlie because he played hooky. I don't know why this stuff is in the papers or even in the courts. I don't know. It is safe to say that Charlie Seeger, a 15-year-old boy, will not be brought into juvenile court anymore on the charge of playing hooky from school. The mother of the lad appeared before Judge Connaughton and was amazed when the court and truant officer John Conboy disclosed to her that her son had been fooling her and that he was not excused from attending school when he told her he had permission from the teacher to remain away. The mother said, "Well, you bet he won't fool me anymore. If I had known it before, I would have stopped it. I'll see that he gets a good punishment." This statement gave Judge Connaughton an idea, and he said, "Well, madam, if you can promise this court that you will give Charlie a good paddling, the matter will be dismissed. The court feels that you can do that more effectively than anyone else." The mother said, "You just bet I will see that he gets a good paddling tonight, but not from me, but from Charlie's older brother. He hits harder than I can." "Well," said Judge Connaughton, "I find this boy guilty of truancy, and the sentence of this court is that he be paddled good by someone of the family who has a good right arm swing. That will be all." Another big thing that happened in 1916, they started paving our streets. Until 1916, we had gravel roads. Here's another funny little story. Ed Gailey, who was given permission to dynamite the river below the CLW Railroad Bridge for the iron, had an experience Tuesday afternoon about 3 o'clock, which has induced him to discontinue the use of dynamite for tearing loose the iron bridge structural work swept away by the flood of March 1913. He used a charge of 3 pounds of dynamite, which did effective work and carried a piece of iron weighing fully 300 pounds toward the west, over the home of the Margadant family on South A Street, and then dropped into the cement walk in the rear of the home of Henry C. Meyer of South B Street, where the iron broke the walk and buried itself nearly 3 feet in the ground. What the consequences would have been had the heavy projectile fallen on the roof of the house of the Meyer family can be easily surmised. The house would have been damaged, and possibly some of the family might have been killed or hurt. Duh. After the occurrence, Chief of Police Stricker called on Gailey and told him of the damage done and gave him orders to discontinue the use of dynamite, and Gailey was heartily willing to stop to stop the dangerous work at once and promised to pay for the damage to the cement walk. On June 1st, a couple of our policemen had a little adventure. Herman was almost killed under a train. Detectives Hederick and Herman had an exciting experience in an endeavor to arrest William Gailey, wanted by the police for cutting to kill. After the affair, which resulted in the search for Gailey, Hederick and Herman traced the fellow to the gravel pit of the CH&D and there found him. As they placed him under arrest, they started towards town with him when suddenly he jerked away and dived under a moving freight train. Hederick and Herman, without the least hesitancy, started after the man and also made the dive under the moving cars. Herman caught the man again and, pointing his gun at his head, demanded that he surrender. The man did, but as Herman replaced his revolver in his belt, he hit him again, grabbed him by the back of the neck, struck him a blow in an instant, and had scrambled out from under the car and had made good his escape. The car caught Herman, dragging him several feet, ripping the sleeve out of his coat, and spraining his right leg. Hederick also dived under the car after the escaping man was more fortunate and was not injured in any way. On the 3rd of July, this is the first Hamilton policeman to be killed in the line of duty. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, Inspector of Police Arthur Walkie was barely alive, and his attendant physicians, Dr. Zerfus and Cook, held out no hope for his recovery. Mr. Walkie has been unconscious ever since his removal to Mercy Hospital Saturday night, and the nature of his injuries is such that his death is only a question of a few short hours. Inspector of Police Arthur Walkie, a faithful and conscientious officer of the Hamilton Police Force, was given a fatal blow on his left temple about 6:15 o'clock Saturday evening while in the search room in the city prison when he was hit by Walter Balser with a blow from the latter's fist. Inspector Walkie, as a result of the violent blows from Balser's fist, fell unconscious and struck his head on the cement floor of the search room. What led to the vicious assault was the fact that Inspector Walkie ordered Balser to sit down in a chair while Dr. Surface could attend to a wound Balser had sustained when he was arrested on his home by Caldwell Street by Patrolman Yarnell, whom he had resisted. Balser was arrested for intoxication and abusing his wife. When he was ordered to sit down, he resisted Inspector Walkie and finally struck him on the left temple and then began to throw himself on the unconscious officer. Balser was finally torn loose from Walkie, and then he began to fight and resist Dr. Surface until he was finally subdued with the assistance of a number of officers. After Inspector Walkie was knocked down, he came to for a moment and complained about his head and wanted to know what it was that caused his condition. He was carried into the office of the mayor, bleeding from the nose and ears, a sure evidence of a fracture of the skull. Dr. Edward Cook was hastily summoned and Inspector Walkie removed to Mercy Hospital. The officer was then in a semi-conscious state and his condition grew worse after arrival at the hospital. The result of the blow on the temple with a fall on the cement floor of the search room was at once pronounced as one that would have had fatal results. The skull is fractured at the base and the man's condition since Saturday night has become more apprehensive from hour to hour until Monday morning when all hope of recovery was given up and the family was called for the hospital. Inspector Walkie had been in the service of the City Police Department since September 18, 1907 as a patrolman for several years and then promoted to Inspector of Police a few years ago. He was formerly in the employ of Fred Hilker, who was at that time the local circulating agent of the Cincinnati Inquirer. He lived with his family at 514 Central Avenue. Balser, who gave the fatal blow, is a driver of the coal wagon team of the Wirtz & Company and was formerly in the employ of the Anderson Schaefer Coal Company. He is a powerful man, and he put all his force into the blow which felled Inspector Walkie. He's locked up in the police station pending a hearing. Of course, he didn't make it. The death of Inspector Walkie seems certain from the time of his injury in the search room of police headquarters Saturday night when he was struck by Walter Balser and knocked to the floor, sustaining a fracture of the skull at the base of the brain. From the time of the injury, Inspector Walkie was unconscious, and after his removal to the hospital, was certain that his death was only the question of hours. He lingered until Monday afternoon when he passed away, without regaining consciousness. At the time of his death, Inspector Walke was aged 48 years, 9 months, and one day. He was born in Michigan, but spent the greater part of his life in Hamilton, where for a number of years he was a carrier for the Cincinnati Morning Paper, and since 1907, a member of the police department. Chief of Police Stricker on Tuesday signed a warrant charging Walter Bosser, the assailant of Walke, with murder. The death of Inspector Walke has been the cause of universal sorrow in Hamilton. He was a conscientious officer and played no favorites in the performance of his duty or in the enforcement of the law. Great credit is due him. He was in every respect a self-made man. Thrown upon his own resources when a mere boy, he worked faithfully to gain an education and a livelihood. Filled with ambition, he sought to achieve such success as might come as a reward of his efforts. Conscientious, he won the confidence of those who knew him best, and especially those with whom he was officially associated. The performance of his full duty came first with him, and in this he won and held the respect of those with whom he associated. In the death of Inspector Walke, the city has lost an efficient officer and a citizen worthy of the esteem in which he was held. At the coroner's inquest, they said that he didn't die from the fall to the floor, but that he hit a table. But here's the story of how Bosser got arrested. Raymond Engler, a lad of 9 years, living at 538 Caldwell, told of Bosser's conduct before he was arrested. He said that the police were called and that Officer Yarnell came and found Bosser on the steps and called the patrol wagon. He said that Yarnell struck Bosser in the eye with his fist when he refused to sit down, and that Bosser then made an attempt to strike the officer. At this point, the boy said Yarnell struck Bosser on the head with his club. Mrs. Gertrude Engler, the boy's mother, said that she lived next door to Bosser and that he had quarreled with his wife on the day of the tragedy. She said that the police came after Bosser early in the afternoon, but that he made his escape. She said Bosser chased his wife into her home and dragged her out, and that later she heard Mrs. Bosser screaming and telling Bosser to stop beating her. Frank Brown, police clerk, said he went into the search room when Bosser was brought in, and that Walke and Officers Johnson and Bowles were also in the room. He said that Bosser refused to sit down in the chair, and that Captain Walke put his hand in Bosser's face and shoved him into the chair. Brown said that during this time, Bosser was cursing and abusing all of the officers, and he said to Walke, "I'll get you." Walke then told him to act like a gentleman, and he would be treated as such. The witness said that Walke turned his back on the prisoner and was walking away when Bosser arose from his chair and hit the police captain a smashing blow behind the ear. Brown said that Walke's head did not strike the floor, but that his cheek struck the side of a desk. This testimony explodes the theory that the injury which caused him death came from when his head struck the floor. Brown stated that when Dr. Zerfus came to dress the prisoner's wound, Bosser attacked him and forced him into a corner. He said that Detective Herman threw Bosser to the floor and put handcuffs on him until the doctor dressed the scalp wound. Charles Herman, city detective, testified that Bosser threatened to clean up the whole police force. He also said that Bosser attacked Dr. Zerfus. Herman said that Walke was of good character, but that he was quick-tempered. He stated that he threw Bosser to the floor before the surgeon could dress his scalp wound. He said that as Walke turned his back after shoving the prisoner into the chair is when Bosser struck him. When examined by attorney Clinton Egbert, Herman said that he did not see the affair in the search room and did not know whether Walke attempted to draw a gun or not. I pulled this one out because we're going to have a Chautauqua this year in Hamilton. Miami University Hamilton is hosting that, and if you don't know what a Chautauqua is, it is sort of a festival of arts and culture. And they're going to have music, and the highlight of the one that we're going to have this summer is they're going to have people living history, and Teddy Roosevelt is among the people coming to Hamilton this summer. The Boston Symphony Orchestra and Sir Douglas Mawson were the main attractions that year. Sir Douglas Mawson was an explorer who apparently had a terrific slideshow from the Antarctic. More death and destruction. This one was an accident, though. Both victims of an industrial accident are now dead. A most distressing accident which resulted in the death of two of Hamilton's well-known and highly respected citizens occurred in the plant of the Hamilton Foundry and Machine Company just before noon Saturday, as a result of which Fred Balmer lies dead at his home on North 10th Street and George Piper lies dead at his home on Forest Avenue in Lindenwald. These two men were among the most valued employees of the Hamilton Foundry and Machine Company, Mr. Balmer being the electrician of the plant, while Mr. Piper was the millwright. At the time the accident occurred, an air tank used for general purposes in the plant was being tested. Mr. Balmer and Mr. Piper were close to the tank at the time when suddenly and without the least warning, the tank exploded. So far as could be learned, it is said that the force of the explosion was so great that the cylindrical portion of the tank was flattened out completely, while the ends of the tank, together with the connections, were hurled with the greatest of force. It is said that this was one of these portions of the tank that struck both Mr. Balmer and Mr. Piper. Mr. Balmer's neck was broken and he died instantly, while Mr. Piper's skull was fractured and he was otherwise bruised and cut about the head and body. The body of Mr. Balmer was removed to the undertaking establishment of David Webb on Main Street, while the police ambulance rushed Mr. Piper to Mercy Hospital, where it was at once found that his injuries were fatal and that his death must naturally result within a short time. The accident, so far as anyone knows, was wholly unavoidable. It is very regrettable, claiming as it did, two of the best known employees of the company. In August was the 125th year celebration of the founding of the fort. And apparently they had a big week-long pageant in Hamilton. And at one night, as many as 20,000 people attended. The pageant, which depicted stirring scenes and the early history of the city, was given with a realism that evoked considerable comment from the large crowd. At both productions, events were pictured in the same excellent manner which was characterized the reproduction from the start, and the large crowd was exceedingly well pleased with the different entertainment features together with the excellent manner in which they were presented. Mrs. Stella Weiler Taylor's style review, which proved to be one of the features of the week, was presented Saturday night and made a decided hit. Costumes showing the various styles from 1791, the time of the founding of the fort, until the present day, were worn by Hamilton Society belles and were shown under the glare of a large spotlight. The novelty reflects the great credit to the committee and to Mrs. Taylor, who directed it. Hamilton woman invents a submarine, wants to give it to America first. Will Mrs. Anna Stanley of Hamilton, Ohio, succeed in aiding the United States government even more than did Betsy Ross? Betsy Ross designed the first United States flag. Mrs. Stanley claims to have designed the first American submarine. As yet, the United States has not accepted the new invention, but they are testing the Stanley Safety Submarine, as the boat is called, at Newport News, says Charles M. Stanley, her husband. And while no offers have been received from the United States, Charles Stanley declares he has received offers from Germany and other countries. But we want to give our invention to our own country first, said Mr. Stanley, and we will not consider any other offer until we hear from the United States government. Mr. and Mrs. Stanley are traveling all over the country displaying the Stanley Safety Submarine and giving demonstrations. During the past week, they have been in Dayton. They show two models, one supposed to represent the Deutschland, the other to represent the first American submarine. The superiority of the latter over the former is shown through demonstrations in a glass tank, illustrating the increased rapidity with which the Stanley Safety Submarine can submerge as compared with the model of the Deutschland. And all this came to pass because Mrs. Stanley asked her husband the simple question, why can't a submarine have two propellers instead of one? It's kind of hard to see here, but it's like at both ends. It looks like a big sausage with propellers at the end. The ordinary submarine has but one propeller and requires 10 minutes to submerge, and the process is done by taking on water ballast. On each end of the Stanley Safety Submarine is a propeller. When the boat must submerge, a lever causes the rear propeller to rise to the perpendicular and the front propeller to descend to a similar position simultaneously. When it is forward or straight back, these propellers are horizontal. So instead of 10 minutes, it requires but 10 seconds for the Stanley Safety Submarine to sink. Once the machine restarts, the rear propeller pulls downward and the front propeller pushes forward on an even keel, and presto! Imagine the entire United States fleet underwater. But according to Mr. and Mrs. Stanley, the United States government is just beginning to realize the value of the new invention. When the Stanley Safety Submarine was first introduced, they declared, the introduction was acknowledged by the government through a dapper youth of 22, clad in a tortoiseshell spectacles and white canvas low cuts. Politely, he told them, the Stanley said, that the government was not interested in the development of submarines. The government doubted as to whether they would ever amount to much, and that there was no money with which to experiment. But that was some time ago, and now Mr. and Mrs. Stanley have reason to believe that the government has changed its mind. Charles Stanley acquired technical knowledge of submarines through 4 years of service with the French government. I was submerged deep, said Mr. Stanley, more than 700 times. When a man marries, he must settle down. Mr. Stanley was fortunate enough to wed a woman of invention of an inventive turn of mind. Back of their Hamilton home, they built a workshop, and between them, they invented a film cooler for moving pictures, which was sold to Thomas Edison Company and other minor inventions. Picture the Stanley family, Mr. and Mrs. Stanley and Charles Jr., seated around the fireside in the evenings. Mr. Stanley's thoughts turned back to his submarine days, and more than once he thrilled his attentive wife with stories of perilous adventures under the deep instead of on the deep. And since many of these perils were caused because there was but one propeller, Mrs. Stanley conceived the idea which resulted in the building of the Stanley Safety Submarine. Why not have two propellers? I tried to do a little bit more research on this, and other than other newspaper articles where they were going around the country and showing this thing off, I don't think the Stanley Submarine ever really went anywhere. We lost another prominent citizen, Lawrence Larche. May not be a terribly familiar name, but he was actually Hamilton's first Republican mayor back in the 1880s. He lost the election to a fellow by the name of Charles Bosch, who was, first of all, the youngest mayor. It was in 1894 that he was elected. He was the youngest mayor ever elected in Hamilton and also served the longest term. He served just a little over 20 years. Lawrence Larche later went on to become the county clerk. October 18th, 1916, we had another murder on Chestnut Street. A debt of 5 cents was the cause of a murder at about 6 o'clock Tuesday evening. It occurred in the rear of the old Tom Keith property at 41 Chestnut Street. Albert T. Bundrant, 32, employed by the Cullen and Vaughn Company, was the victim. Bundrant and John Higgins, both colored, batched at 25 Chestnut Street. George Marshall, 39, lived with his wife in the second story of 41 Chestnut Street. Marshall was employed by the State Highway Department on a road being constructed near the city. According to what could be learned, Bundrant owed Mrs. Marshall 5 cents, and her husband accused Bundrant of the unpaid debt. The lie was passed, and Marshall, it is charged, went up to his room, secured his .38 caliber special revolver, sped down the back stairs, and started to continue the quarrel about 15 feet from the hallway to the upstairs. Both men clinched, it is said, each with a revolver in hand, so it is said, and while Marshall held Bundrant's gun, he shot Bundrant in the half, passing through Bundrant's heart and lodging in the back just under the skin. City building is condemned by state inspectors. October 20th. Mayor Holzberger and L.J. Ziliox, president of council, have each received a copy of letters in reference to the erection of a new city building from the State Industrial Commission. Dear Sir, an inspection was made of the city building located at Monument and Market Streets, Hamilton, and that would be, if you think of where the old municipal building is down there, the parking lot. The city building was in that parking lot right there. By deputies Bates and Dance, and in consequence of the following order is issued. Considering the facts set forth in the accompanying detailed report of this building, it is hereby ordered that you vacate this building for all public use on or before December 1, 1916. See, as stated, the building is of composite construction, and as near as I am able to learn, was built sometime near the year of 1840. There is a part basement under this building, which contains the heating apparatus, which I might say at this time is in very dangerous condition. The smoke pipe leading from the furnace to the stack is rusted away so that one can shove their hand between the pipe and stack connection. This, of course, will admit of sparks or blaze to easily set the building afire. The foundation of the entire building is of small rubble stone laid up with common lime mortar, and in places some has fallen out, and rats and vermin are permitted to run unobstructed throughout not only the basement, but the entire building. The first floor of this building contains the police department office, the courtroom, and police emergency automobile patrol, a city lockup, and a room 14 by 40 feet, which is commonly known as a flop room or tramp room. This room contains 15 double bunks, which are three sections high, and the mayor tells me that at one time last winter, there were 108 tramps confined in this room at one time. Yowza. There's absolutely no ventilation from this room. It is of composite construction, and most of the men confined in the room smoked. In consequence, it is a very dangerous fire hazard. The building is overrun with vermin and bugs of all description, and of all the unsanitary places that I have visited as an inspector in this department, this is the worst. The second floor, and it describes all these safes and filing cabinets that are on the second floor, they are all filled with paper, which is very heavy. It has been necessary in several instances to reinforce the second floor under these safes and cases, and to the best of my judgment, this floor is absolutely unsafe and should be relieved from the overload as soon as possible. Further, the east wall of the building, a section of which had been taken out to admit the placing of a large door for the police automobile emergency wagon, the remainder of this wall from this opening was cut in such a dilapidated condition that it collapsed and fell into the building. To illustrate what the clerks of the different offices think of this building, I wish to make this statement, which the mayor himself told me, that when they were delivering coal to be unloaded in the basement of this building, the several clerks on the second floor would leave their desks and go to the other side of the building, which shows that they are in fear that this wall will collapse at any time. The city gas office is in the front part of the building and on the second floor directly over the mayor's courtroom. The gas office contains three of those safes heretofore mentioned. The room on the opposite side of the hall from the gas office also contains one of these safes. The mayor informs me that at times when it is customary for people to pay their gas rent, he has seen a line of people extended from the front of the building up the stairway to the gas office and down to grade line. The point I'm trying to make is this, that one could not imagine the outcome of a calamity that might happen at such an occasion as this, when at the same time the mayor's courtroom might be overcrowded. I understand that this building has been condemned by several different state departments, but nothing has been done heretofore. Therefore, considering the structural weaknesses of this building, the unsanitary condition of the same, and also considering the fact that there is no ventilating system in the building, neither is there any fire protection, the heating system is inadequate, I would call for this building to be vacated for all public use on or before December 1st, 1916. Yours very respectfully, Alfred Bates, District Deputy.
Only in Hamilton, right?
Another shooting. This one happened at 5 o'clock Sunday evening in late October at South Conn and Parrish Avenues. Edward Durham of 200 South Conn Avenue shot Leonard Crank, 20, boarding with Amos Durbin at 1256 Central Avenue with a repeating shotgun in the left side of his breast and arm. A number of leaden pellets entered Crank's neck and face and perforated his soft hat. Crank was removed to Mercy Hospital, and for a time it believed that the wounds were of a critical nature and would end fatally. The trouble between the two young men originated from a remark made by Durham, who was in his stable feeding a cow. Crank and Turner Webb, with Letha Goose and Lily Powell, were passing the stable to the rear of the Durham house, and while going through the alley, Durham told this little girl to shut the door of the stable or the calf would run out. Crank, it is said, took offense at this remark, and Durham became angry because Crank objected and made a move as if he intended to draw a revolver. Durham said that when he was threatened and Crank made menacing threats, he ran into the house and got his six-shot magazine shotgun and discharged two shots at Crank, who was nearby trying to get across a field. When he was shot, Crank was taken to a house near the foot of Gobbler's Knob, a hill in the vicinity of Parrish and South Conn Avenues. After the shooting, Officer Lenz placed Durham under arrest in the city prison. He had $126 in it. Wow. In his pocket when he was arrested. That's a lot of money for a guy on the knob. He came back from Jackson County, Kentucky, and was employed at the Tile Tool Works as an electrician. Apparently, he lived. But a judge got up on his high horse over this. On October 31st, 1916, determined to break up the practice of persons carrying concealed weapons in Butler County, Judge Murphy imposed indeterminate penitentiary sentences on two prisoners who pleaded guilty to the charge on Monday afternoon. The two men were Richard Curtis and Andrew Johnson. Before imposing sentence, Judge Murphy said, "Not since the law was passed making it a penitentiary offense to carry a gun in Ohio has a man ever been sentenced to the penitentiary on that charge, but it seems that the past leniency of the courts have been trifled with, and conditions have become worse instead of better. A veritable wave of crime has passed over Butler County, and at this time there are 5 murder cases awaiting trial. This court believes that the majority of these murders have been carried by gun-toters, and for the future protection of society, anyone coming before the court on such a charge in the future need expect no clemency." On December 19th, they found Walter Balser guilty of manslaughter and the death of Officer Walkie. Walter Balser took the stand in his own defense, so a summary of his testimony follows. On July 1st, he only worked in the morning. In the afternoon, he went back to work and put up his horses and started for home. On the way home, he stopped at a saloon and had some beer. On arriving home, he told his wife he was going to town and got some shoes half soled. His wife did not like this and raised a lot of racket. One of the neighbors heard this and called the police. The police came in the patrol wagon about 4:30. As soon as Balser saw them, he ran from the house and got in a taxi cab and drove to the police station and gave himself up. He was told he was not wanted and immediately returned home. No one was home on his return, so he sat down on the front steps. That's when Officer Yarnell came along and arrested him. He tried to get up from the steps, and the officer told him to sit down. Balser said he answered, "I do not know whether or not I have to sit down as I am in my own yard." It is alleged that Yarnell then struck him first with his fist and then with his club. He was knocked unconscious and knew no more until he arrived in the search room of the police station. He said Walkie came in and cursed him. This made Balser mad, and he asked Walkie to step outside and said he would whip him on a dime. He claims Walkie then struck him in the mouth while 2 policemen were holding him. Walkie then told the men to turn Balser loose and he would finish him. He claims Walkie struck him and missed, and as he missed, he reached for his back pocket. Seeing this, Balser claims he struck him. Some teeth alleged to have been knocked out by Walkie were shown. The bloody shirt and undershirt were also submitted as evidence. They found him guilty of manslaughter and gave him a 20-year sentence. And that's the news of 1916. My next appearance here will be on April 14th, and I didn't know this until recently, but there's a very famous murder in Kentucky, the Pearl Bryan murder, and they say her ghost still haunts Bobby Mackey's saloon, and they found her body on the river there without a head. Well, it turns out that one of the men who was charged with the crime was from Hamilton, and there's some speculation that Pearl Bryan's head may be at the bottom of the Great Miami River. So we'll explore that one in April. I want to thank you all for coming out, and we'll see you next time.